Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Many years ago, I went cross-country skiing on a pristine winter day in New Hampshire with my dog, a lovely, loyal mutt named Amos. As we emerged from the woods, I paused at the edge of a snow-covered field to appreciate the late afternoon light. The sun was settling in an orange sky beyond the green rolling hills frosted with fresh snow. The beauty of the day filled me with a sense of peace and contentment. I looked at Amos, who looked back at me with his deep brown eyes, and at that moment, I felt sure that he was feeling the same thing about that day, that we were sharing an appreciation of this sublime moment. So I went back home, told a friend about the experience, about the perfect afternoon and the deep connection with my dog, and he laughed and said, "Dream on, Brooks. Your dog was just thinking about his next meal." Was he right? Well, I don't think so. Anyway, all this relates to my next guest, the famed primatologist Franz Deval. Deval is upending assumptions about animal intelligence. He's shown that chimpanzees have a sense of fairness, that apes plan for the future, that even crows can recognize human faces and hold grudges, and that octopuses like to play. And he asks, why are humans so quick to downplay animal intelligence? And what do we lose when we do that? His new book is called Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? And he'll be at the Harvard Museum of Natural History tonight. And he's with us now. And Franz Deval, welcome to Radio Boston. Great
I'm
to have you.
I'm happy to be here, yeah.
It's really good. And we want to invite our listeners into this conversation. Listeners, are you smart enough to know how smart your animals are? What questions do you have for Franz Deval about animal intelligence? Give us a call. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And Franz Deval, I'd love to start with that question. Why are humans so quick to downplay animal intelligence? It seems like a lot of folks, or at least traditionally, we don't want to sort of accept that it's like our intelligence.
Yeah, well, there was a time actually in Darwin's days. Darwin wrote a whole book about animal emotions. People were much less reluctant. But that in the last century, we have seen all this sort of tightening of the position, and especially here in the U.S., the behaviorists, they try to explain everything with simple learning. And in Europe, where I'm from, the biologists, they talked about instincts. And so animals either were instinctive or simple learners, and that was all there was to it. And it's only in the last 25 years or so that we have a new generation of scientists who doesn't believe that necessarily anymore and tries to test animals in much more complex ways, so not in the little Skinner boxes where they can only press a lever, basically, but in much more creative ways and much more attuned to their capacities rather than comparing them necessarily with us.
Yeah.
And that has given us a lot more information, I think.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned Skinner boxes, because it takes me back to my freshman year in college when I took a freshman survey course in psychology. And sure enough, you know, our sort of foray into animal behavior was a Skinner box, mm-hmm. and putting a little rat in a box and teaching him to push a button to get a drop of water, and that as sort of, I don't know, some kind of proof of that's as far as the intelligence goes.
But think about it. What you do is you put a rat in a box where there's a lever and he can get rewards. And of course, all that the rat can do is that, and all that he will do is that. And so you're not really challenging the rat to see what the rat is capable of. There were some scientists, even in those days, Tolman, and he lived on the West Coast because he wanted to get away from Skinner and his folks here. And so he did cognitive maps with rats. And he had already, this is like 100 years ago, had very different ideas, even about rats.
Yeah. You mentioned Darwin, and I want to ask about Darwin, because wasn't he getting it right? You begin the book with this great quote, and the quote is, "The difference in mind between man and the higher animals, great as it is, certainly is one of degree and not of kind."
Yeah. Darwin had looked at apes at the London Zoo, and so he was familiar with animal intelligence. He had a very high opinion of animals, and he could not see, and I'm a biologist also, I cannot see how we could have the human smartness that we see around us without some stepping stones in other species. That would be sort of impossibility, yeah, evolutionarily speaking. And if you look at our brain, our brain is not fundamentally different from a monkey brain. It's a much bigger brain, but it's not a different brain. So there's no parts in your brain that a monkey doesn't have, which means that basically the mental processes must be very similar that are going on.
Well, speaking of monkeys, one of the things you describe in the book is tickling a young chimpanzee. And I'd love it if you could describe this for us and why this was such an interesting thing for you.
Well, if you tickle a young chimp, like a 3 or 4 year old chimp, it's like tickling a child because they have the same tickling spots in their sides, in their neck, in their belly, and they're equally ambivalent. They make laughing sounds like type laughing, and they have a laughing face, and it's very hard not to laugh if you tickle them, and they have this, as I said, the same ambivalence. They try to get away from you, but they also come back for more tickling, and I always feel that if an animal is so close to us, we need to use the same language. And one of the big arguments against studying animal cognition is that we should not be anthropomorphic. Mm-hmm. We should not use human-like terminology for animals. But if you have an animal so close to us, it would be a bit like if you have a horse and a zebra and they show very similar behavior, and you ask me to use different terminology for what the horse does and what the zebra does. A human and a chimp are about equally close as a horse and a zebra. And so we need to use the same terminology. And this whole charge that we get all the time, be less anthropomorphic, be more careful. And so they ask me, for example, if chimps reconcile after a fight, to call it post-conflict contact, or if they laugh like a young chimpanzee, to call it vocalized panting. Yeah. So they say they want different terminology, but I think that's totally ridiculous.
See, I'm really interested in this idea, this sort of pushback against the anthropomorphizing, because, and again, I sort of confessed sort of my limited education in this field, which dates back, way back when I was a freshman in college. But the way it was explained to me is that we do animals a disservice if we try to sort of impose, kind of Walt Disney-ish ideas onto them and not sort of embrace their wild animalness.
Yeah. But we do, of course, we see these parallels both in the positive and the negative behavior. It's not like Bambi and Walt Disney. Right. I've seen chimpanzees kill each other, and I call that power struggles. And in that context, too, I use humanized language, basically, because it looks very similar to what humans do to each other.
Yeah.
So it's both on the positive and the negative side, basically.
Sure. Listeners, we're talking to Franz de Waal. His book is Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? What do you think about that question, and what are your questions in general about animal intelligence, animal cognition? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Jameson calling from Reading. Jameson, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, thanks for having me.
Sure.
My question was just for your guest there. It has to do with consciousness generally. So both human and non-human consciousness. Most philosophical theories, at least I think most of the newer ones, look at consciousness in terms of sort of human beings at the top, but that all non-humans sort of at least having some degree or some level of consciousness. I'm wondering how intelligence plays.
Oh, by the way,
can you hear me?
We just faded out, Jameson, but I think we got the idea of your question.
I think I got the question. So there was recently a philosopher who said that, of course, consciousness arises from the number of neural connections in the brain. And obviously, humans had the most of them. And so humans must be the most conscious. And I'm not convinced of that, because we now know that actually elephants have 3 times more neurons than humans. That came out recently. And so why not assume, if that's the case, that the elephant has more consciousness? The way we get at these questions sometimes, because we cannot measure consciousness directly in any way in animals, but to look at processes that we cannot do unconsciously. For example, chimpanzees plan ahead. They plan for the future. They take tools with them that they can only use three hours later or something like that. And planning is something that we cannot do unconsciously. And so we look at these processes, we test them in animals, and as a result we say, well, if they do this planning activity, and we do it consciously, why would we assume that they're doing it unconsciously?
I'd like to hear more about that idea about chimpanzees planning. You actually begin the book with a story about Frangie, a female chimpanzee, right? And this sort of, I mean, your book is fascinating, and it's fascinating from the first sentence. And tell me the story about Frangie and how you figured out that, well, she's planning.
What she did was very simple. In the morning, on a cold day in November, she collected all the straw from her cage, and she took it outside, and she built a nice warm nest outside. But if you think of it, it was actually very complex, because she was inside a nice and cozy, warm building,
yeah,
and she didn't know yet that it was going to be cold outside. Now, she must have been extrapolating, I suppose, from the previous day. She must have been thinking, like, it's getting cold, and I'm going to take my straw with me. But that takes planning activity. That takes an extrapolation from a previous day to a future day, and that's what she was doing. And there's many of that kind of examples for the apes.
Right, and I guess the kind of new thinking about this that you represent is, once upon a time, the sort of idea about that was, this is a result of the instinct for survival, pure and simple, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or simple learning, simple associative learning. But it all broke down already a century ago. Wolfgang Köhler was a German psychologist who would hang a banana very high, and then he would give his chimps a bunch of boxes and a bunch of sticks, all too short to get there. And he said already, and this is 100 years ago, he said his chimp would sit around for a long time staring at the situation, and all of a sudden he would stack a few boxes and reach the banana. And he said he had solved the problem in his head. Mm-hmm. He had been thinking about the problem. And people couldn't stand that, especially the Skinnerians. They couldn't stand. Köhler's name cannot be pronounced by many psychologists. They can only hiss it, because he was the first to say that animals actually can think in their heads.
Mm. Mm. Why? Why the resistance? I mean, is this culturally based, or you know, does it date back to sort of almost a religious idea where, of course, you know, we're God's number one creation? I don't know.
It's entrenched in our culture and religion that we have a soul and animals don't.
Yeah.
There's also the old Greek idea of a ladder, you know, like God at the top and then the angels and then us and then everything below that. So in our culture, there's a long line of thought that we are special. We are special creation also.
Yeah.
And I don't subscribe. I'm a biologist. I don't subscribe to that at all. I think we are animals. Yes, we are maybe special. We have a big brain and so on. But our cognition is not fundamentally different from that of other species, I think.
Yeah. Well, let's take a couple more calls. Beth is calling from Melrose. Beth, you're on the air with Franz de Waal.
Yes, hi. I was wondering, I have an elderly dog and an elderly cat, and so I've just been wondering, do animals know when they're sick and dying, and do they experience fear?
Yes, I think animals know when someone else dies, and so all animals who have attachments, they're very affected by the loss of somebody else, and sometimes for example, birds who can be very attached to their partner, after the partner dies, they may die because they stop eating. So attachment and loss is something they definitely know. Whether they can extrapolate from there to their own death, their own mortality, I don't think we have evidence for that, and I'm not sure that they can.
Hmm. Franz, well, I'm interested in, you know, I told that story about the sort of moment that I had, which sort of felt transcendent at the time with my dog on that beautiful afternoon skiing. And there were two things going on. One, it was just sort of my communion with a beautiful day in nature. But I really had the distinct feeling that my dog was there with me, appreciating the same thing. I don't know. What do you make of that? And of course, everyone who has a pet, a dog, a cat, you know, feels something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as a scientist, I would, of course, say, well, we have to distinguish between what you want with your pet and
exactly,
sort of your desires of how you have your relationship and so on, to what the pet actually was thinking at that moment. And I'm not sure I can determine that. So there's limits to what we can know about animals.
All right. Well. Yeah. Maybe you'll come skiing with me next time, and you'll be a little closer to the situation, and you can help me figure it out. Okay. More amazing animal abilities that I want to ask you about that you mentioned in this book, like one study with African elephants recognizing different human ethnic groups. Do I have that right?
Yeah, yeah. So the African elephants, they are scared of the Maasai, because the Maasai sometimes spear them and attack them. And they are especially afraid of man, because it's the adult males who do it, of course.
Yeah.
And so they have tested these elephants with playback studies, and they have found that they can distinguish language. So there's another group of people who roams the same savanna there that they're not afraid of. And so if you play their language, they're not scared. And they make distinctions between male voices, female voices, boys' voices. And so they have basically determined determined that the African elephants can distinguish languages and human genders.
It's incredible. Yeah. It's amazing. Let's go to Sydney, who's calling from Somerville. Sydney, you're on the air.
Hi. It's nice to be on the air. I listen all the time.
Glad to hear it.
I am a board-certified behavior analyst, and I've been very interested in what Sister Walt DeWalsa had to say about Skinner and the boxes and behaviorism. I just wanted to kind of touch back on that because as a new board certified behavior analyst, I have seen that what Skinner had to contribute to the field of learning has been very valuable, and that he wasn't really looking only at he wasn't implying that the behavior of animals is only simple, but he was looking at very simple behavior. But he trained up very complex behaviors with rats and with pigeons, and this is not my area of expertise, but. Animal behavior is not my area of expertise. I work with kids with autism. But I do want to make sure that there's credence given to behaviorism, which has had a tremendous effect on very complex human behavior and has contributed to the field of learning. And I wouldn't want listeners to think that behaviorism is implying that behavior of animals or humans is simple.
All right, Sydney. Well, let's let Franz de Waal respond.
Yeah, I think Skinner had the right idea, and I think many of the behaviorists had the right idea about operant conditioning and its power. It's a very powerful technique, and anyone who trains animals, or trains children for that matter, is using these techniques. And so it is a very powerful system, but it's very limited also, in the sense that, for example, Skinner and his followers, they felt that if you knew enough about rats and pigeons and how they can be conditioned, you know everything about all the animals. And that's, of course, not correct. In the cognitive studies, we look at the senses and the different, so for example, an octopus or an echolocating bat or an elephant or a primate, they're all very different characters. And conditioning doesn't get there to explain the variation in behavior that we see. So it is not a wrong. His ideas are not wrong, but his ideas are simplistic and very narrow, I think. And it was all about controlling animals and getting them to do what we want them to do, whereas we are now much more interested in what they do spontaneously and what kind of capacities they use spontaneously.
And Franz de Waal, you make the point in the book, which I found really interesting, that a lot of tests that have in the past tried to assess or evaluate animal intelligence, that it was the tests themselves that sort of limited the outcome of that test. I'd love you to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, there's a lot of negative outcomes that we should not have reached, but people are so eager to find differences between humans and other species that they have been very eager to embrace. As soon as they find that chimps cannot do this or cannot do that, they were very quick to embrace that. And let me tell you an interesting story on that. This was elephant study. They wanted to know if elephants can use tools. And so they put food outside of the cage of the elephant. They give the elephant a stick. And if you do that with any primate, he picks up the stick and he will get the food closer. But the elephant was not doing anything with the stick. And the conclusion was that elephants are not tool users. But elephants have a trunk, which is a grasping organ, which is also a smelling organ. And what the scientists proposed afterwards, after they did some other tests, is that the elephant doesn't want to shut off his smelling organ in order to grab a stick to reach food. The test that they did is they put a bunch of boxes out and hung food very high. The elephant could not reach the food. But the elephant would go out of his way, would go to other parts of his enclosure to pick up boxes and bring them to where the food was and to stand on them to reach it. So the elephant was basically using tools, but was not willing to use the trunk. And we humans had decided that if an elephant uses a tool, it has to use its trunk. We had decided that for the elephant, but the elephant was not sort of agreeing with that.
Really, really interesting. Joanne is joining us from Salem. Joanne, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I'll ask my question and then hang up. I'm interested to know how your guest reconciles our society's treatment of livestock animals, particularly those that are very intelligent, such as pigs, and that, you know, in our use of them as livestock, and they basically spend their whole life suffering. Like, their life is one of suffering, particularly the females when they have to lay on their sides. They can't stand up, and they're feeding their young. So I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
All right, Joanne, thanks for that question. Yeah, Franz de Waal, I mean, it seems like coming to terms with a closer understanding of animal intelligence has to have a sort of an effect on the way we think about livestock.
Yeah, I think the kind of work that I do has moral implications, and we're already seeing that to some degree in society with how we look at circuses, how we look at killer whales in captivity, how we look at chimpanzee research. I'm very much, of course, involved in that. I'm involved in Chimp Haven, where that's a sanctuary that receives ex-laboratory chimpanzees because chimps are not being used for biomedical studies anymore. And so there are these shifts coming now. They have not reached the big one. The big elephant in the room, so to speak, is the agricultural industry, because that's where the big numbers are and where really bad treatment, very poor treatment of animals occurs. And I think it's going to reach that one day. It's going to be massive if that happens. But for the moment, there's an enormous amount of resistance because there's an enormous amount of money involved.
Yeah.
But I think it's going to happen. I can see that. I can feel in society that people are thinking differently about animals.
How do you think about that, if I may ask? I'm curious, what's your attitude about meat, whether you eat meat or the kinds of meat you eat? Or?
Yeah, I do eat meat. I try to avoid mammals, but I'm a biologist, and in that sense, all organisms eat organisms. And so I don't see meat eating itself as necessarily the problem. I see the treatment of animals as the problem.
I see, yeah.
If the animals that we eat had a good life, that would be different for me than the sort of lives that they have now.
You know, you ask such an important question in the title of the book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? And by the time you conclude the prologue, you conclude that we are smart enough to know that. But why is it so important to know that and to understand the implications?
Well, we need to test the animals in the right way. And so we need to adjust to each species, which is easy enough with chimpanzees and bonobos. They're very close to us, very similar to us. But with an elephant or an octopus or a bat or a bird, it becomes much more difficult. And so we need to be very creative to find the right ways to test animal intelligence. And for each species, I usually call it in plural, intelligences and cognitions, because for each species, it's somewhat different what they can do and what they're specialized in and what are the features that they have in their cognition. And for us, the big challenge is to come up with the right tests. Mm. So for example, people have done a lot of interesting things with corvids, with the crow family, with how they hide food and how they find it back and how they know what others know about their food and so on. And that's a typical paradigm that you can use with these birds because they hide food very automatically all the time. And so you can test it out. And we need to find tests that suit the species, so to speak.
I get it. All right. Well, let's take a couple more calls. Gwen is calling from Maynard. Hi, Gwen. You're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just so excited to hear this discussion because I've, for such a long time, felt that not only do we, well, maybe that's not a lack of intelligence in trying to know how smart animals are, but a lack of imagination. I think, you know, you talk about wanting to avoid the sin of anthropomorphizing animals, but I think we also can anthropocentrically, like you were saying, design the tests. Yeah. In a way that's human-centered, so we fail to see what the animals are doing requires intelligence. So the things that we point to prove how superior we are, you know, symphonies and great architecture and arts and medicine, I mean, those things mostly benefit us. In fact, they almost entirely benefit us and a lot of times hurt other species. So my thinking is that animals could be doing stuff that requires an unbelievable amount of intelligence that we just simply can't perceive.
Yeah, yeah. I've actually invented a new word, which is anthropodenial, which is sort of the counter word to anthropomorphism. I think anthropomorphism is really not a problem. It's animals that are very similar to us, because the assumption ought to be, evolutionarily speaking, that if they show similar behavior to us, that it's similarly motivated and there are similar processes behind it. And people who want to deny that, I think they're in anthropodenial. So that's sort of what I say. And as far as the comparison with humans is concerned, that's not really a very interesting comparison. For example, the question, are you smarter than an octopus? I find that not a very interesting question. Well, you can read and write and talk and all of that, and that's wonderful, and I don't think the octopus can do these things. But the octopus does all sorts of other things that he needs in his environment. He can change color. There's the mimic octopus, which mimics the movements of fish and of sea snakes and adopts their color. We don't know how they do it. It must be based on observation of these animals and then adopting their postures, which is really a complex cognitive process. And so the octopus is doing things that you cannot do. And we may dismiss that as not so important, but that's only because we don't do it and we cannot relate to it.
But aren't there, I mean, this is tricky. I mean, it does seem like, and maybe I'm falling into the old trap, the old paradigm of that sort of hierarchy of the animal kingdom with us on top. But here we are talking about animal intelligence and devising experiments to make clear how intelligent animals are. Doesn't that set us apart in a pretty distinct way?
Yeah, it sets us apart. And there's many species who are set apart. Like there's animals who can echolocate, like bats and dolphins. And that's a very special skill that we cannot really relate to, and as a result, we don't consider it equally important. But I don't know why that should be. So yes, we are special. We have very large brains, and we are very smart. No one is denying that. But we should judge each animal sort of on its own basis and on its own environment where it needs to survive.
Let's try and squeeze one more call in here. Danny is calling from Newton. Danny, you're on the air.
Wonderful. Hi. Fascinating conversation. I'm really interested in it. My question is really a moral question. I know you're not saying humans are the same, not at all, same as animals, but if we are equating them to some degree, then what keeps us from judging humans by their abilities, and particularly from us judging the value of humans who are weak and vulnerable, with those who are disabled, those who are unable to do certain things? How do we have a moral structure, moral framework where we uphold the dignity and the goodness of all humans?
You mean that by, let's say, bringing down humans a little bit or bringing up animals a little bit, we are sort of getting into a moral dilemma on how we treat humans? I'm not sure we are. It's still, humans are our species, and we're biased towards our species very clearly, also in our moral systems, and I'm not against that necessarily.
Well, this is a fascinating conversation, and sadly we're out of time, but Franz de Waal, what a pleasure having you, and thank you for coming in.
It was great.
It was really wonderful. Listeners, thank you for those great calls. Franz de Waal is a professor at Emory University Psychology Department, author of the new book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? And he'll be talking about the book with WBUR's Vicky Croak at the Harvard Museum of Natural History tonight. You can find more information about that at radioboston.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Can you trust Facebook as a source for news? We'll ask the Globe's Hiawatha Bray. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.